Come, spellweavers, reavers, rogues, and men-at-arms, and answer the call of adventure. Pick up your sword, your axe, your spellbook, your bow, your rulebook, and your dice, and join the forces of good in their eternal fight against vile monsters, conspiring min-maxers, horny bards, and blood-soaked murder hobos. Discover the treasure trove of role-playing games here on Rollin' Bones. My name is Ryan Howard, and I shall be your guide.
Good evening, Boneheads, and welcome back to Rollin' Bones with Ryan Howard, where we are making old school young again. I'm your host and king of the Boneheads, Ryan Howard, and tonight we've got some great topics on deck for you and a couple of great guests. We are joined by the co-authors of Horde Wars Basic and the forthcoming Horde Wars Advanced. That is, of course, DM Blackwall, and joining us for the first time, his co-author, Nathan Lindy. So I'm looking forward to talking with these guys. We're going to be talking about Bronsteins. We're going to be talking about medieval battle tactics and weaponry, the clash of arms, and how these things marry together. So before we bring on our guests and begin that awesome conversation that I'm looking forward to, I want to remind everyone to like, share, and subscribe. If you enjoy what we do here on Rollin' Bones and want to share it with your friends, just give us that little algorithmic bump. I can never say that word correctly. That is how you let people know that we are out here. Also want to remind everyone that you can find everything Rollin' Bones related on various social media platforms, including X and Instagram at Howard_RyanGreg. YouTube is Rollin' Bones. Twitch is twitch.tv/RollinBonesRyan. And Substack is RollinBones.substack.com. This week on Substack, I am getting very topical and very spicy, because I am writing an article where I compare AI art to the Voight-Kampff test from Blade Runner. So if that piques your interest at all, stay tuned. Probably tomorrow I will have that article up for you guys. We are streaming live right now on X. Some of you are watching us on X. So those of you who are watching on YouTube, hello. Those of you who are watching on X, also hello. Thank you for supporting us on, the platform of your choice. So that's it for all of my stuff right now. You can find my Substack here. I'm going to drop the link in chat for you guys. There we go. And let's go ahead and bring on tonight's guest. Once again, you can find these guys on X at DM Blackwall is Blackwall social media handle. He is the go-to guy on social media for all things related to Horde Wars. You can find their content on Big Geek Emporium, which I will drop the link to in chat here in just a second. But to bring on our esteemed guest, let's bring on the returning one first and foremost. You all know him and love him. He's a great guy and a great mind, a great historian and a great game writer. Ladies and gentlemen, DM Blackwall, welcome back to Rollin' Bones.
Good to be here, Ryan.
Absolutely. Good to have you back. And let's bring on the new guy, his first time here on Rollin' Bones, the co-author of Horde Wars Basic and the forthcoming Horde Wars Advanced, Mr. Nathan Lindy. Welcome to Rollin' Bones.
Thanks for having me.
No problem at all. All Yay. Right, so are you behind?
I guess maybe a little bit.
No, it's all good. You're caught up now. Alrighty. Cool. So let's kind of kick things off a little bit. We haven't done this over the past couple weeks, but it's coming back, ladies and gentlemen, because there's been updates. There's been movement on this front. So let's dive right into the Ginger Report. Late last week, Harmony Ginger, our good friend at Ginger Blast on Twitter, posted about 5 weeks of using one-to-one time. Once again, kind of furthering the conversation around one-to-one time, Bronstein-style play, basically communicating her praxis of the ideas that people in the BroSR and other related groups have been talking about. And the responses continue to just really be interesting.
Yes.
It's amazing to me how people are receptive to these ideas now. Blackwall and Nathan, what are y'all's thoughts on this phenomenon? Like, I haven't talked to either of you about this, so where do y'all land on this?
Well, for me personally, we had some experience running this style of game more than once, but probably the longest running was about a 3-year stint that wound up in the second generation. And this would have been back, what, Nate, 07 maybe?
Yeah, probably in that range.
And so this was, but this was a custom setting that we had a group of about 15 players get together and build in a single long weekend of work together. We did probably 40 or 45 hours of work per person to build the setting. And then we played in it for about 3 years. That was a lot of fun. And we were operating on 4-to-1 time. So we had a month go by between game sessions, which were weekly games. And we also had 2 or 3 ongoing game groups simultaneously in the world with different game masters.
Gotcha.
So I'm familiar with this idea, and it's very old. It goes back very nearly, actually, I guess technically before D&D, though its implementation along with playing an individual character long-term is probably a closer to the late 70s.
Yeah.
My interpretation... So a little bit about my background is I used to be a venture officer for Paizo doing Pathfinder Society. And so I kind of got used to doing kind of their timing stuff, and I felt kind of work. But essentially, I came to a conclusion. I use what method makes the most sense for the campaign I'm setting in. Like if things are, you know, just adventures in the, you know, dungeon, it's up to them to set maybe the schedule. You know, instead of the 1-to-1, 1-to-4, I would generally probably set more to 1-to-4. But sometimes, like in a, you know, generational campaign, you need more time to go past. And so 1-to-1 just doesn't give it to you, especially if you have different races going involved and stuff where their aging is different. Maybe a season or maybe a year goes by. What makes sense for the story. And that's where I sit personally.
I understand where you're coming from. I mean, me personally, these are newer ideas for me. These are ideas that I've just recently come into contact with and have been exploring. The thing that I've found is whatever story you have in your head that you think is going to be awesome and that you want to kind of plan around, especially with the timekeeping aspect, it pales in comparison to the emergent story that will come out of just keeping a 1-to-1 record of time and seeing how the players interact with the world in that regard. So
to be clear, I believe what Nate meant, and perhaps I misunderstood, was that based on the core campaign concept is how he'd set the time scale.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Not so much how the game itself is going or a story he's got in his head. We're both pretty big fans of emergent gameplay, actually.
Gotcha. Okay.
But if he wants to set up a game where the buy-in is you're playing a family vying for power, right, mm-hmm. and their retainers... that's going to have a different time scale, or should, than if you're playing some guys delving in a dungeon every other day.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of like the difference between running a D&D campaign and running, let's say, a Pendragon campaign where you have the whole lineage that you're playing through. Is that what you were getting at, Nathan?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. And for there, I would say it just, if you're not using 1-to-1 time, it's just a matter of having a like set idea of timekeeping, which it
Yep.
Based on Blackwall's clarification, it sounds like you would agree with that. So I think we're aligned there.
Yes.
But the Bronstein talk does not stop there, because we focus a lot on the Ginger Report and the progress of one Harmony Ginger in spreading these words to the masses, but we should not forget about the villain himself, the man whose name sends a shiver up some people's spines, Jeffro Johnson. And he has recently been talking about the Bronstein again. And this is not so much in response to Harmony, but this in particular, I think, is a response to Questing Beast and his video about the original Bronstein. So just to read this tweet out here to people who are unfamiliar, Bronstein framed as, quote unquote, the first RPG by some. Arneson's first fantasy campaign was billed as a Bronstein. David Wesley, widely considered to be a genius and gaming hero, yet only Jeffro demonstrated that you could incorporate Bronsteins into D&D campaigns. You guys might have some pushback on that, since you have run games this way before. knew who Jeffro was.
But not just us. Let's pick a much older man. Jim Murphy. Mm-hmm. He was running games like this in the 1970s. So Jeffro's claim involves a man who was doing it before he was born. So Jeffro is ridiculous. He has merely reinvented a thing that was already in existence, and when I was a young gamer, was taught to me by older gamers.
And honestly, that's a fair criticism of Jeffro. I like Jeffro as a person.
Sure.
I've talked to him several times. I think what he does on Twitter is hilarious, but I think even he would tell you, if you backed him into a corner, he's not inventing or discovering things. All he's doing is shedding a light on things that have not been widely talked about or widely discussed in a very long time.
Yes. And I think part of that is a lot of the people who were aware of that or interested in that kind of play are not so much the same people who have stuck around on the internet saying these things, but they've stuck with their home games or extended campaign groups. For example, Nate and I have visited a group of buyers of Horde Wars Basic that I think two of them have an internet presence of any substance, and the whole rest of their group, who have been playing for like 40 years or more in most cases, just not on the internet, not telling people think about what they're doing. And I think that's the case for a lot of the older school gamers.
Yeah. And for like a lot of them, as times change, they just add the elements they want, or, you know, like, oh, I kind of became that. Sort of kind of order to stick was, hey, new edition rules kind of joke. But, you know, sometimes that happened, and maybe even keeping the same characters and just converting them.
Yeah, bringing older concepts over and then adapting to something.
And so the question, do they consider it a Bronstein or whatever? It probably is one, but the question is, it's always been this. And so I think for a lot of the games, it's just that's the game they've been in, the living game they've been in.
Yeah. Now, something that Jeffro says in this thread, and I'm not going to like read it in its entirety because it's a Jeffro thread. It's long, but something that he kind of spoke with me about just in DMs and talked about in that thread, Jeffro is starting to kind of make the case that every D&D campaign, when considered rightly, is a Bronstein. And I'm kind of in agreement with him on that. And to make my case before I turn it over to you guys to respond, a Bronstein is multiple factions being controlled by players working both together and against each other to forward their own individual goals.
Mm-hmm.
that's kind of your basic breakdown of a Bronstein style game. In the most basic unit of D&D, the group of individual adventurers, you have questions of why is this cleric going down into this dark pit with this thief? Why is this paladin adventuring with this mercenary fighter? There's all of these questions that are kind of baked into the D&D party of how are these misfit adventurers who have kind of seemingly different alignments and different outlooks on the world, why are they working together to go down into this hole? And the answer is there's treasure at the bottom of this hole. All of them have different uses for the treasure, and they've all kind of made this tacit agreement of whatever we find down there, we split equally. And then, you know, we use that treasure that we get from this adventure that we undertake together because we need each other's particular skills to navigate this dungeon. We each take our share of the treasure and do what we will with it. Most people don't think about it this way, but that is Bronstein play, because once you come back out of the dungeon, the cleric is going to go take a majority of that loot that he gets and tithe it back to his temple. The thief is going to go do God knows what with it. The fighter is going to go buy armor. Everyone's going to go off in their own individual directions and use their treasure to further their own goals in some way. And this is only amplified the higher level that you get. So in a way, I think Jeffro is actually correct about that. So with that said, what are you guys' thoughts on that?
So I think he would be correct if you're assuming a classical D&D adventuring party. However, most actual games, at least most that I've played in, and I've been playing for quite a while now, are not classic D&D parties. Many of them have a specific buy-in or tone, either that the game master or the players themselves have organized. For example, I have actually game mastered for a party of all paladins. That was insane. And they were the same kind of paladins, I should note. Like, they were worshiping the same god. So that was a different experience than what is being described here. The same would be true if you were a company of mercenaries who are working to further their company's goals. If these are the mercenary officers, I've run that game. I've played in that game. Or if you are a family vying for power, for political or economic control of a nation. Now those are all possible games as well, and are not the classic one. I think the classic one does more strongly have the Bronstein elements, but when you get to self-organized parties, like a party of all wizards that I had players plan, or rather coincidentally create, in a game a month or two ago, they all showed up with wizards. They hadn't talked. That was very interesting. when they pick a theme like that, it's like, oh, well, okay, that's, I guess we're doing that then. And so I think in its simplest form, yes, but as you play in a wider variety of campaigns, then no.
So,
yeah, it's sort of my own spin. Like in Pathfinder Society or Adventure League or any of those, it's more simplified. Go to your classic. We're all going down, do that. Even those in modern tellings, there's basically a kind of organization goal. Yes, you're doing it for yourselves to further your own individual characters' goals because you're you. But there's usually a kind of organization or you're doing this for someone for plot reasons. And, you know, and there's even times when the parties go, you know, we're not strangers anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes a slightly different it is, you could construe it for their own good to stick together, but sometimes more altruistic, like the campaign we had, which did probably closely follow it. We basically became the founders of a town and different factions in that, but we were in charge of the town at the end of the day.
Mm.
And so we did have sort of our own mini goals and families and whatnot. But then you have the, well, we actually have to act together or else we're going to lose everything.
Right.
Yeah.
It became a kingdom builder based around that one town that they controlled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I see what you guys are saying. In that situation, though, it sounds to me as if you guys chose in that circumstance to all align around one particular goal. Whether it was a mono party or, you know, we're all working for, you know, the benefit of this mercenary company, kind of a Black Company style game, like you mentioned there, Blackwall, or even the, you know, we're all working together to, further the prosperity of this town that we founded together. In your example, Nathan, the players are deciding based on kind of the circumstances that they find themselves in to align their goals with each other. But in a circumstance where a player would have chosen something different, there could have been conflict. There could have been potential for kind of a breakaway style Bronstein, where you then, as the GM, have to arbitrate between these two different factions with two different goals. So the potential is still there. It's just a matter of what do the players decide to do with their autonomy? Do they decide to band together, or do they just decide to break apart and pursue alternate goals? And I think the presence of a choice there is the difference between, considering this as a Bronstein and, treating it like a conventional D&D game. Just the option of we could go in a different direction. That's what makes the difference.
It could become a Bronstein game, yes. But the thing is, Bronstein by its nature requires conflict. You are different factions, not a faction. The moment you become a single faction, the Bronstein game is over. Because it's a victory condition. It's a war game. And it's an excellent style of war game. It's a lot of fun. And it's a good way to help with world creation or the resolving conflicts or even generating plots in an RPG. It can be quite a bit of fun. But it is, at the end of the day, a game where there is a winner and there are losers if you are successful.
Yeah.
Which isn't the same thing, typically, as a role-playing game, though a role-playing game can certainly become that.
Yes. And like in past society, there's a scenario where you, in the old days, you all picked a faction. You can very Bronstein.
Mm-hmm.
And your character had missions on every mission to do. And some of them put you in direct competition with your party members. But in their storytelling, eventually, because you're all part of one super organization, they basically said, you got to put that away. And that's what the story was trying to tell you, is at some point, when you become powerful enough, you need to think of the bigger picture. And that was the storytelling that you did there in that specific scenario. But yeah, they have that choice. They can continue doing the thing that they want to do, and that's fine. Everyone has agency. And that's part of the fun, where this is not a video game where I just pick ABC and see what happens. different stories can come out of your actions. And, you might become an unplayable character in the scheme of things. I don't know how many times they turned around and said, hey, let's get Nate, because he decided to go off the deep end. necromancer or
there may have been a little killing.
Like, it happens. And the thing is, the people remember that. You know, that this is going on. But it comes down to the buy-in of the people going, okay, what are we trying to do? Are we here to have a game maybe together in the gaming sphere? Or is this, you know, Axis and Allies?
Yeah. Now, I will say, it is quite fun when you have parties often being run by different game masters, though sometimes the same game master, who are in the same game world and have opposed goals. I don't mean like a player or the head of a faction. I mean an entire party of players who directly opposes another party. That can be quite fun. We've had that a number of times, including for entire campaigns. And that gets a lot more interaction because the inter-party hostility is a bit more focused, if you will, than if a player is the necromancer off doing his creepy thing, or if a player is controlling a faction of assassins. It's interesting to see inter-party conflict, including the point where we've actually scheduled throwdown fights between them and their minions.
Yeah. Now, along the same lines here, John Miller in chat has a question. He asks, does a Bronstein require that players have at least some goals that conflict, or does it only require that players have goals that are independent of each other? Blackwell, you've already kind of voiced the opinion that you know, Bronsteins need to have conflict. And I think, to be clear, I was quoting
the guy who invented them.
Yes. Yeah. The where I would kind of break away from that is I do think it's more independence than direct conflict. I think that the independence of goals will inevitably lead to direct conflict when you basically take the independence of goals to their logical conclusion, because you have parties that, just based on the archetypes present in role-playing game books, are as extremely different from each other as I am a holy man devoted 100% all of my life, all of my everything to this religious order, and my entire life is built around stealing things. Those two things will inevitably collide with one another at some point. It's just a matter of when are we allowing these conflicts to erupt, or are we completely putting these things aside? But when you consider those goals independent from one another, and you kind of take away this overarching notion of the party must stick together, otherwise the game fails. When you take the idea that diverging goals means the game has failed off the table, then you have set yourself up for a Bronstein-style game. Even if the party never breaks, the groundwork is laid there, and kind of at the heart of your game lies the foundation of a Bronstein, should the players decide to pursue those goals doggedly, independently from one another.
Not even goals. I have two parties right now in playtesting who are actively pranking each other, doing things like stealing hats. And the pranks keep escalating. At some point, somebody's going to get hurt. But that's been hilarious. And for a while, one of the parties didn't know it was other players in the world. They just thought NPCs were doing this.
Mm-hmm.
It took them a while to figure it out. They're like, wait a minute, those jerks. And they know each other, like the people in real life. So they started texting each other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, that kind of thing can be fun. But in general, if you're going to have that style of play, you should be able to have multiple game masters and at a minimum have multiple play times, because with strongly divergent goals, they're going to need some time to play away from each other.
Yes.
And if you can't facilitate it with multiple sessions, I mean, I guess you can do it through messages and stuff, but that's not probably going to be as fun most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, any other thoughts on that, Ryan?
Nathan, let's turn it over to you for a second to get your thoughts on that, and then...
I think it all comes down, I guess I've always been kind of a storyteller. What does the story not necessarily need to happen? Because when you do these kind of games, you're creating the story together. It's not a book, this is what happens. You could think of it as the setting's happening, what did the characters do to it? And then go from there. But
you're talking about emergent story. Yeah.
Emergent story, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that, hey, I found my brother's sword in the tomb. I don't need to go adventuring anymore. So why would my character, you know, continue? Unless, like, okay, I want to help my new group. Like, I have a new goal. Which is a very Bronstein idea. Like, why am I doing this? You know, Custer is like my faction or something. Like, we need this to, you know, I have the seal, so now the family lead. You know, stuff like that. And the question is, does that completely destroy the story? Or is it able for you to now go, and that story's over for that character, and now we can do something else? And I think that's where the game masters kind of get like, can we have that much flexibility? And I think that's hard for some people because it's a question of what's the campaign's end? What's the goal?
Mm-hmm.
What they can get to it. And that's how I usually think of these. and so it's fine if each character has their own individual wants or needs. The question is what happens when you actually succeed and fill those?
Mm-hmm. I see what you're saying. The problem that I have with kind of that outlook, and this is coming from someone who has written not just one, but several multi-page backstories for characters in his past.
Oh, don't do that.
Again, like, I come from horrible gaming habits. I come from the worst of the worst theater kid habits of the, like, 5e generation. When you start out with a notion of my character is adventuring because, and the answer is anything other than I'm tired of being a peasant and I want to improve my life, you set yourself up for early retirement at that point.
Yep.
Once you get a bit of an adventuring career under your belt and you start to interact with other NPCs, other elements within the world, and you start to take on some of these goals that you've earned through adventuring with this character of, oh yeah, this character has a strong attachment to this village that was just burned down. Now I want to avenge that village. That, like, that's different from I am starting out as someone whose village was burnt down, and now my single-minded goal is to kill the man who burned down the village at level one, starting out in this campaign. And so I think the best way to kind of address that is to begin the campaign with basically no notion of who your character is and discover who your character is as you play, lest you set yourself up to... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, that goes away from the Bronstein style where you have a backstory. You have your goals and wants.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Well, but even within the Bronstein framework, your character's goals are baked into the class, because each class has multiple levels where certain things happen. Like, as a fighter, your goal is to become a general and then ultimately to become a king. because, or at least a noble, because at 10th level, you become a nobleman with a keep at a stronghold. As a cleric.
Oh. That doesn't have to be your goal at all, though. That'll happen even if you don't want it to in that game.
Yeah.
But when you kind of remove this idea of starting out at level one with a goal in mind, that is your default goal, is to become a noble. And then as you play, more things are added on to it. So basically the advancement of your class kind of sets out the path that your character is originally on. And then anything that you encounter along the way is kind of like picking up side quests for your character, with this ultimate goal in your mind still being, I'm going to become a noble, or if you're a cleric, I'm going to become a saint of my religion, or I'm going to lead my own parish, or you know, kind of however it breaks down in whatever game system you're using. As a thief, I'm going to become a master thief, and I'm going to have my own thieves guild.
So yeah, but we agree that immersion story is better, that writing a giant backstory is actually a really dumb idea. If your game master reads it and tries to incorporate it, get a new game master. It's not going to go well almost all of the time, because the amount of dedication required to incorporate and blend, say, six players who each sent you a three-page backstory is you're going to be a dysfunctional group over time, even if you start out okay. I would recommend finding the story together and experiencing your backstories together. For example, you can have an emergent backstory. You could go to town and suddenly somebody runs up and slaps you like Jack Sparrow in Pirates of the Caribbean. And how you respond determines why that person slapped you. And your entire party gets to experience that and see what was going on in your life previously, rather than you having some novel for them to read. You can choose to incorporate it, that kind of idea, that way. I've done that, and it's been really funny to watch. I got a guy who just always picks the worst option as to why a thing might happen. And so all of the other players are just watching this horrifying drama of what happened to him in the past unfold live as we play over the course of multiple sessions. So like a lady comes up and slaps him and is like, where have you been? And he decides that's his wife, and that he left her years ago with the kids. And then later, he bumps in, it comes out that he may have been sleeping with the neighbor's wife also. And then it comes out that there was this lady he left at the altar in another town. And then it just snowballed. But this is a series of choices by the player, not me.
Mm-hmm.
It all started from one person that I initiated going up to slap him and his reaction and decisions. And so you can have that kind of thing, and that can be quite a bit of fun. But the difference is novel that maybe the DM read versus a story you all actually got to experience and that the player made meaningful decisions in, and the rest of the party could potentially intervene in some way and interact with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and that idea of the emergent backstory is pretty cool, and it does lend to some interesting moments. And I've had moments like that happen at my table, and they are generally crowd pleasers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, those things, I don't see them as conflicting at all with kind of the built-in goal structure of, you know, yeah, the fighter got slapped by who it turns out was his estranged wife.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The fighter is still pursuing this goal of nobility, and maybe even that was the catalyst for what caused him to leave his family and,
yeah,
you know, sleep with the neighbor lady and all that stuff. But so I think these two things can exist together.
That is what I was saying.
It's just a matter of, you know, whether or not, basically how you're introducing these things are, like you said, you don't want that to be part of your novel length backstory.
Yeah.
So I think we're aligned on this.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. And oh man, is it fun for the other players?
It is. It's I've actually I I've had that moment happen with players in a game that did not continue, but the emergent, like the piece of emergent backstory that my players came up with is now included in what's going to be published material in Nighthaven.
So, oh, that's great. That's really cool. So should we move on to our next topic? Time is going past.
Yeah. We can talk about kind of this next topic, because as you know, everyone knows the inevitable conflict of Bronstein will lead to the clash of arms and the the buildup of armed forces and armies. And
oh yeah,
one thing that really, really grinds my gears, sends me into a tizzy fit, is when people talk in a very ignorant manner about the weapons and arms and tactics that are used in medieval style warfare, because that's what we're dealing with in fantasy role-playing, is medieval and late medieval and early Renaissance style warfare. So you guys are experts in this stuff. Your book Horde Wars is kind of built around these ideas. So I guess to begin this, where do you guys, like, how much emphasis do you place on the importance of understanding these things in your own games and your own experience gaming?
On the personal scale, the I'm playing my character only scale, I think it's vitally important to have a good understanding of what weapons will be effective against what opponents, and what weapons might have additional uses beyond their plain function. For example, the difference between a sword that can reach opponents further away versus one that can do additional damage. Well, what uses might this have? Although typically the ones that with further reach are also high damage. Because of, you know, the nature of how force is multiplied. Also, for example, knowing what armors do. So in real life, medieval knights basically never fought each other in combat with swords, with one exception, when they were both wearing gambesons, which tells you that gambesons were not effective armor against swords.
I remember once watching a documentary on YouTube, you can call it that, where they took like an English longbow and they tried to put it against plate armor. And I think they fired 100 shots from like different things, and basically they had to be point blank to actually penetrate it. So it shows you right there, like, it sometimes you can get lucky, but they were hitting the chest, the actual plate. So if people got damaged by it, it was, you know, the grooves and stuff like that. Or like, why did knights have daggers and things of that nature? Because when you horse someone, have them fall down, the only way to get them is through, you know, not the plate, but the little gaps. And so you need a blade small enough to get in.
Yep. Right. That was one of the tactics, which is why Horde Wars Advanced is introducing the long knife. Which is precisely for that purpose. Mm-hmm. But you would also use things like warhammers, which despite their name look a lot more like a spike. And the same is true for maces and flails and so forth. Your goal typically was armor penetration, using various methods, because your typical peasant's stick or bow wasn't capable of penetrating the armor, at least not reliably. If you ever get the chance to watch it, A Knight of Hope on YouTube is an excellent representation of what would happen if one knight decided to fight like 30 guys who aren't in plate.
Yeah, there's this escalation of tactics and arms that comes as the medieval period wears on.
Yes.
It's best summed up by a quote from Gary Oldman's portrayal of Jim Gordon at the end of Batman Begins. It's this very subtle line right at the end. He goes, "We start wearing armor, they buy armor piercing rounds." Yep. That is like the story of warfare and the development of arms and armor. Knights weren't dressed like that just because it looked cool. It had a utility in the field of battle that they were entering, and then things like the Warhammer, the Bectacorbin, all of these various different bludgeoning weapons were designed to counteract this heavy armor that knights were wearing, because it turns out, you know, you can't slash through armor, but you can dent the hell out of it and cause severe head trauma by caving in a knight's helmet with a hammer.
Yeah.
And even like the daggers, the long knives that you guys mentioned, they were specifically shaped so that you could get up under the like chin protection of a knight's right. helmet.
Or through the eye slit or yep. up through the armpit. Yep. Back of the knee as well.
So all of these weapons are designed with a purpose. Mm-hmm. And when you understand that purpose, you get away from this mindset that I've heard, unfortunately, some very influential people, you guys know who, Matt Colville, yeah. say, you just have this list of weapons and none of them really make a difference. They don't make a difference because you don't know how to deploy them in your combats. And so when you understand the way that these weapons and tactics were deployed and used in the field of battle, you understand why you have to have so many different varieties of polearm or so many different varieties of sword.
Yep. Yeah, it's unfortunate that he, that he decided in as a design plan to make equipment essentially meaningless. Because he really is, not just with the weapons, though that's true, but with all the rest of the basic gear. In his game, you just assume they have all the things they need. That removes an entire dimension of play and yeah. of challenge. It's not that you couldn't hand wave those things in any other game, but you should at least include the rules so people who want to play a more serious and engaging game can. Whereas his game explicitly forbids such rules. But by his own account, which is just terrible.
Well, it's like your choice is a great sword or a great axe. One's a D12, one's 2D6. And that's as far as Matt went. And you go, okay, the 2D6 is probably better, so we all should be barbarians with great swords from that game.
Or whatever it might be.
Or whatever. Sense, it is. But in reality, these weapons all had different purposes and did different things.
Yeah.
And so in Horde Wars, we definitely tried to make it so every weapon had some, not necessarily unique, but it had a property that was based on their actual use.
Yeah. Yeah. So Ryan, I don't know if you can pull that up or not, or if you, just so that people can see, we'll probably have to zoom in a bit.
I've got the game pulled up right now. Let me go ahead and show it to everyone.
Yes, we're talking like page, 50, 51 in there, as written in the text. So it might be a little further depending on your PDF reader.
Weapons, here we go.
Yep, keep going. There you go. And if you zoom in on that table so they can read it.
Yep.
Maybe one more.
There we go.
Cool. So you'll see that axes, we gave all of those the heavy property. All that means is if you crit, which in our game is on a natural 12, the axe does an extra die of damage, which is also doubled. Yep. And the reason we did that is because axes, when you really nail someone, will typically just kill them.
Mm-hmm.
Or provide a wound that is sufficiently lethal that they will not recover. Not every blow with an axe will do that, but if you really nail them, that is exactly how an axe should function. It's a very swingy weapon, if you will. Yep. But also, it's a tool. And you'll notice the poleaxe, though we've categorized it with axes, it has the penetrating property. What this means is it, on a critical hit, ignores the protection granted by armor. So it functions the way a poleaxe would function in the Middle Ages. You would want to use one against a guy in plate or against other heavy armors so that you can hurt him the most. And with this 1 in 12 odds for a critical hit, and you getting more than one attack per turn, there are is a very good chance that will happen in a combat. And you'll see for the flails, similar setup, the clubs. You've got a stunning property, which on a critical hit removes the next action from your opponent. And you've got, you can see the penetrating property on like the Morning Star and the Mace. Same deal, can ignore armor protection on a critical hit. So you can see some of these ideas. Now, our protections in our game involve reducing damage from specific damage types. So it matters if you're doing blunt or piercing or slashing or whatever, because the armor actually protects you. Because that's what it did in the real world. It didn't make you harder to hit. That's ludicrous. It made you harder to hurt. Anyway, so as you go down, you'll see daggers have the assassination property. Knives do. Why? Well, it's because in real life, if you're going to be in a knife fight, you want to win it in the first 5 seconds. And ideally, before your opponent has acted at all. Like, we're trying to motivate you to reward you for using knives the way that they should be used if you're going to be fighting with them. Which is from behind.
Now, the I do have a question here, because this is another thing, another aspect of real-world combat that I have not seen kind of properly portrayed in other role-playing games. The dueling dagger, is this kind of y'all's answer to, like, the main gouche?
Yeah. So we were really between that and the long knife in function. And so we decided to put the dueling dagger in basic and put the long knife in advanced. That way, anyone who wants it has access to both. But essentially, daggers really can be used to block, at least if they have a wide guard on them. And that is a thing that was done. Typically more towards the Renaissance, though, not as much in the earlier Middle Ages. But still definitely a thing that, that can and would be done. Hopefully that answers your question.
It definitely does, because the rapier is kind of like ever present in role playing games, just because of it evokes a certain style of fighter, and so people who want that more swashbuckling style will often go for the rapier. Yes. However, the rapier was usually paired with either a buckler or a main gouche as a defensive weapon, because you can't really parry that well with a rapier. It's a very thin blade. It could break easily if you try to use it in that regard.
Well, plus you need spring steel really to make rapiers, and that's relatively high technology. Yes. And the springiness of it means that you could block with the blade, but yeah, as you said, a strong enough blow, it'll snap. Or and rather, a long enough bend, it may just stay bent.
The other good thing that I see here, and this is something that I was thinking about just as we started talking about this, the brace property here. Where you can set a weapon against a charge. When you think about the way that hobgoblins are traditionally presented in role-playing games, and that they're basically Romans with pointy ears. If the party ran across a war band of hobgoblins specifically with shields and spears, would the hobgoblins' first inclination not be to immediately form up and brace against their attack, so that, you know, the players that rely on melee weapons, when they go, I move into attack, you as the GM go, how?
Well, you go, oh, sure, you're welcome to. And they've held their actions to attack you. And now they attack you. You got close enough, you know. And and so the pike really has the reach advantage. One of the reasons that we limited that to just a few weapons, the reach property, by the way, is because in our game, combat spaces are 2 yards or 2 meters. And so most weapons do not reach beyond that from you, because that would mean the opponent, typically, if you're in the middle of your space, would be like 9 feet away. There aren't lots of weapons that reach that far.
Yep.
And so it's just on a few of those weapons. However, the brace property, what it means is if you damage someone with a crit, they get knocked prone. And why we did that is because of the use of these weapons. Pikes and spears and glaives tended to be used against mounted combatants.
Yeah.
Or against other people with pikes, spears, and glaives in block formations. And the way you break up those formations is killing or knocking them prone. The way you knock out those mounted chargers is you knock down their horse or knock the guy off the horse. So all of these weapons, the glaive, the spear, and the pike, are good against cavalry in a meaningful way. In particular, of course, as you'd expect, even if the guy lives through getting critted on and knocked off his horse, you're all going to have bonuses to hit him now that he's on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's probably dead, especially if there's like a knight charging a mass of pikes or a mass of spearmen. Because the action economy alone, like you're screwed, which is what did in fact happen in warfare. I mean, you wouldn't normally charge straight at those polearm formations. You'd hit them from the side where they weren't ready for you.
Mm-hmm. And going back to your original example of your, say, barbarian, your party charging the, unit of hobgoblins, they should fail.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a reason why well-trained units can take out most threats.
Mm-hmm.
Even in, modern day terms of the thing. That's not what they're designed to fight the single person that runs right at them. And so definitely one of our kind of goals with this book is assume people are competent. Yep. And that involves also believing that they'll eventually figure out proper tactics.
Mm-hmm.
And having all these different options and different weapons, have them kind of treat to go, okay, in this situation, how should I handle it? Which that involves, experience at the game table, going, okay, that did not go well.
Yeah.
We won by the skin of our teeth.
Yeah.
We can't let them throw their, javelins. Like, think of the Roman legionnaires, mm-hmm. Throwing the javelins first and then taking their, spears and, rushing us or in formation. Yeah, yeah. That's scary.
Yeah, and the answer, or at least an answer, if you have the resources on hand, is to use the wizard to break apart the formation.
Yep.
So if you've got a wizard with fireball, that's what fireball does in the field of battle. You drop it on a formation and suddenly the legion that you're fighting with the kite shields and the spears, or the tower shields and the spears, whatever the case may be, doesn't want to form up anymore, because then they're all presenting one massive target for the fireball.
Right.
Then you get to come in with individual units or with longbows or however you want to approach and take out the individual soldiers.
Plus, you can make a gap in an existing line with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you scroll down a bit to the next page, there you go. You'll see some staves, swords, and some exotic weapons, most of which are our medieval period, though some are slightly different cultures, which we threw in there because we knew people would want to play with them. But yeah, hopefully they're all pretty straightforward. You'll notice the main difference between a broadsword and a rapier is simply the damage type for the game. Mm-hmm. Whereas the difference between those and a scimitar is a scimitar behaves more like an axe. Crits does an extra die of damage, because in reality, that is how a scimitar does function.
Yep.
Whereas swords are excellent at cutting down unarmored opponents. The way we're representing that here with the impact property means you crit on an 11 or a 12. Twice the odds of critting and doing double damage.
Mm-hmm.
Less of a special ability if you crit.
Yep. Yeah. And this kind of gets into something that I've been enforcing in my own game, which is set inside a city. In the city of Nighthaven, it's perfectly legal and even expected for people to wear swords.
Mm-hmm.
However, it is not permitted to carry around pole arms.
Yep.
Because a sword is a personal defense weapon, and a pole arm is a weapon of war. And this is a situation where that is a clear distinction. A pole arm is used basically to take on armies or take on armored enemies, take on mounted soldiers like you guys mentioned. But, you know, a sword is a personal defense weapon. And should you come up against an armored enemy such as a guard trying to keep you from doing something, your sword's not going to be as effective as you might think it is.
Well, certainly not against knights. Against a guard, it may be effective enough. They, you just have to hit the right body part.
Yeah.
But
against a guard carrying a pike, it might be a different story.
A group.
Yes, a group of them.
One guard with a pike, he's screwed. Get in under that pike blade, he's dead.
Yep.
The thing you have to remember about the pole arms, too, is they were developed to hunt, to kill the big beasts. So even in like a fantasy setting, the take on the dragon, the take on, you know, the troll. So they weren't just to keep on people. They were the deep base weapon for humanity forever. Where swords were almost exclusively made just to kill people.
Yes.
Because they don't do well hunting or doing anything. So like an axe is a tool. A mace and a flail were originally base tools. A knife is a tool. But a sword was designed to take on people, mostly unarmored, but generally did pretty well. And so like you're saying, like in civil society, we kind of use that as a, this is really used against us.
Yeah. And there's a good example of this historically. There was a point where you were to be considered a man or at least a free man with rights in the community in medieval Friesland, you were required to own a sword.
Yes.
Peasant or noble, which gave you an idea. And this was partly because when they needed to defend the place, you could be called up and you had a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was partially a militia thing and partially a, it is expected you be able to defend your home and your person.
Yeah, and this is an kind of a fascinating aspect of the medieval martial ethic. Whether it's individuals being required to keep up a certain style of equipment should, you know, a call for an army to be raised come through, or whether it's a baron being required to keep an armory for his barony, there is this expectation that weapons are to be kept and maintained and trained with to a certain degree in the event that the realm needs defending. So a lot of these weapons, especially the simpler ones or the more personal ones, like a sword in the example that you used, or you know, a spear and a round shield, it would be expected that every able-bodied man would know how to use these to a certain extent, because if the, you know, the kingdom goes to war, they're probably going to be called into service by their baron.
Well, sure. And even in like in England, there was mandatory training in certain areas with longbows. Why? A longbow isn't the best hunting weapon, in part because if you're in heavy brush, it's a bit big, it gets in the way. It's explicitly a war bow. It's good at war, especially in open fields.
Yep.
And
especially with multiple being used at one time as kind of a primitive artillery.
Yeah. Oh, couple comment there. So, John, to answer your question, the PDF is available through Big Geek Emporium. You can also order physical through our email, which is, which I think Ryan can just put up in the chat in a moment, actually.
Yep, you guys can buy physical copies at HordeWars@BlackWallGames.com, which you will find here in the chat.
Yep, and you just email us that you want one or more copies, give us your address, and then we can send you an estimate on the shipping. It's $25 for a soft cover plus shipping. If you're in the U.S., shipping's pretty straightforward. Canada and Mexico looks pretty doable. If you're outside of that, I would strongly recommend buying the PDF because shipping it overseas is insane.
Yep. Yes, it is.
Unless we're talking like 1,000 books at once. But if you're ordering that, you should talk to us.
But yeah, this is one of the things that I really appreciate about you guys' game is the amount of thought put into why all of these weapons should exist. I mean, before we went online here, before we started streaming, you guys were talking about the lance and the differences between, as it's written here, the tourney lance and the battle lance.
Yeah.
Because this is a weapon a lot of people don't understand. They see like the scenes in A Knight's Tale and think that's the extent of the lance, but the reality of the situation is that's not the same lance that was deployed in actual cavalry charges.
Right. Right. Now, that was a lance built to break with a thing to soften the blow on the end on purpose, in part because of how scoring worked in jousting, and in part because they were trying mostly not to hurt each other, because this was a sport or practice for real combat. Mm-hmm. But a battle lance, that wasn't made to break at all. It was meant to spear through people and remain intact. So the properties of them, I mean, among other things, you would never put, I mean, without getting in really serious trouble, you would never put a metal core in a tourney lance. That would be both cheating and potentially kill your opponent.
Mm-hmm.
Battle lance, why not?
Especially if, and bringing it back into the realm of fantasy, what you're charging is not an opposing army, but a dragon.
Ah, yes, like the Lance of Ascalon. Go kill a dragon. Yeah.
Because again, like Nathan pointed out earlier, a lot of these weapons, you know, you look at the boar spear, which is basically a short sword on the end of a stick with cross guard and everything to keep the boar from charging all the way through it and killing you. These weapons were designed to kill things that were in motion. So,
yeah.
Even, you know, you deploy the battle lance even against an opponent's horse or against, and this is kind of mixing eras and people groups, but, you know, if you had an opponent that was on a war elephant, a lance might be the difference between getting trampled and not getting trampled.
Oh, sure. I'm pretty confident that a single lance blow would fail to kill an elephant.
Yes.
However, you it's probably could hurt it. And if you had enough of those, you might be able to kill it.
But regardless, you probably did stop the elephant's charge. Now it might just grab you and do something to you. But that's...
You got its attention.
You got its attention.
And hunting or... Not hunting, but fighting an opponent mounted on an elephant might look a little bit more like Native Americans hunting buffalo, where you're riding in a circle, mm-hmm. throwing spears from a distance rather than trying to charge up on the elephant with a lance. But the general principle is keep your distance and spear this thing so that it stops moving.
Yep. Yep. Or if you get the chance... Get it to run into like a Betis's or a pit trap and then have everybody stab it.
Yep.
So hopefully that helps give you guys who are watching or who will watch in the future kind of a picture of what we're doing in Horde Wars to try to play around with medieval weaponry and tactics. As this applies to mass scale combat, though, having an understanding that a mass of pikes, at least if the flanks were anchored, were very good at stopping cavalry, understanding that masked longbowmen were typically quite bad at killing knights, but they were excellent at killing their horses. understanding like how these weapons would be deployed not only will make for more believable battles in your games, but also will make for more believable outcomes if you decide to run like a Bronstein style thing and you don't have a good grasp of how different units might counteract one another. There are a number of excellent war games out there, but even just a basic book on medieval tactics, you know, that's like 60 or 90 pages with some color illustrations will give you enough of an idea to go, oh, okay, here's how light cavalry were used, or here's what peasant militia might be armed with, or these kinds of things. Now, in Horde Wars Basic and then Advanced, we include a bunch more. We actually show you, so when you raise peasant levies in Horde Wars Advanced, there is a stat block with a particular group of weapons that you get as those peasant levies. Or there are specialized mercenaries, both in Basic and Advanced, a specialized crossbowmen and pikemen and heavy infantry and horse archer and this kind of thing.
And that's, I remember, in medieval times, a lot of the soldiers were actually mercenaries, especially towards the Renaissance eras.
Oh, yeah.
And so these are specially trained people, and they knew how to counter each other because that's how they were paid. And so especially our kind of fighting styles that we use, like all the different weapon types, kind of puts into that vein of there's no single one that kind of beats all. It's what do you need to do for the job?
Yep. Yeah, it's... It is kind of a rock, paper, scissors type situation where, you know, this counters this, but this can counter that. Unlike rock, paper, scissors, you have multiple different solutions that can be deployed in different ways. So if you're facing a cavalry charge, but you don't have cavalry of your own, you can do what the medieval Chinese did and hide underground. And when the horses come up, you pop up with your sickles, which is why the kama is a martial arts weapon, and you cut the horse's legs out from under them.
Oh, yeah.
There are so many different things. And what I want to kind of close on here as we're starting to reach the end of our time, why this is so important and why I admire the dedication that you guys have put into this. When you don't think about combat as a puzzle of how do we overcome this armor, these weapons, the situation that you're in, when you don't consider these factors in combat, all you end up with is what I call the JRPG pocket dimension, where you've got two forces lined up across from each other and you take turns whacking each other.
Right. When in reality, asymmetrical warfare was used. Now, this guy was not the inspiration for Robin Hood, in part because the stories about Robin Hood are older than this fella. But there was a archer who might have been a minor noble who managed to raise a group of 1,000 other troops that waged asymmetrical warfare on the French when they invaded England at the invitation of a bunch of English barons. And he's credited with killing, specifically the French credited him with killing, him and his men, over 5,000 French troops. That wasn't in one fight. They kept ambushing them in the forests of southern England. And this was an ongoing thing for a few years. So it wasn't just two sides line up and fight. I mean, same deal with like the Battle of Stirling Bridge. Yeah, the two sides did line up and fight. Why? Because they were literally fighting on opposite sides of a bridge. That's the only reason. Other than that, they would have been wheeling and moving around and trying to outflank one another and this kind of thing. It wasn't static battle, and it wasn't just everyone charge, because that's really stupid, unless you outnumber the enemy 10 to 1.
Yep. And you even see this deployed in the American Revolution, you know, Francis Marion the Swamp Fox takes, you know, similar tactical approaches. Or even if you get into the era of the American Civil War, Mosby and Quantrill and their raiders.
Yeah.
Where Jesse James and, you know, the Western outlaw is born in these Confederate raiding parties. It's all asymmetric warfare, and it's all, you know, understanding of tactics and the tools that they had in hand. And
oh yeah,
you not only can, but should be applying this to your games.
Well, and for asymmetrical warfare, castles often functioned as a form of asymmetrical warfare. The most ridiculous version that I'm aware of, though there probably is a more ridiculous one, was a castle held by less than 30 troops, held out successfully against a king of England and the army he raised for months, which is just hilarious and just shows the incompetence of that particular king. Looking at you, King John. but that, 30 to 19 guys, roughly that range, successfully held off an army of thousands raised by John for months. That is asymmetrical warfare. Just less mobile.
Even in the Crusades, they went and took the forts on the coast. So they had a direct path to do so. Why? Because they knew the enemy could hold those forever and they couldn't make their way back. You know, they needed the supply routes, they needed the, you know, retreat points. Like, people were not dumb. I think that's what I have to keep explaining. I'm actually a college professor on the side, like, historically. And, like, people think they are just because they didn't have all this stuff. But, no, they knew how to use what they had and what they needed to do. And so, if the odds were ever fair, someone screwed up.
A balanced fighter is a result of poor tactics.
Yes. And is actually one of the reasons that we stayed away from a challenge rating system for our game. It's because no fight should ever be fair except by accident.
Yep.
It could be strongly weighted towards your side or the opposing side or a little bit one way, but it almost never will actually be exactly even. And trying to force that to happen, I think, makes for a very unrealistic game world and a kind of boring play experience over time.
I mean, there's a saying with all the old campaigns and stuff for like D&D 1 edition, all that, there be dragons. Yeah. All you need to be said, like, go there, you're going to die. Why? Things there kill people. You know? You're going into these tombs to raid it for their riches to empower yourself or whatever. Say whatever noble go you want, you're a tomb raider. And, you know, people put, you know, guardians and stuff in there and traps and whatnot. But, like, in the D&D world, you're legit going down there and sacrificing your life, possibly. Shouldn't you be?
Yep. And this is like, this is a whole nother topic and definitely a reason to bring you guys back at some point to kind of continue this conversation, because there's so much more to get into with this. But the idea that combat needs to last a certain amount of time, it can't be too long, it can't be too short to be fun. This is a false notion, because a combat let me reframe this. There is always the possibility of entropy with the dice going wrong or there being some kind of unexpected or unseen factor that was not considered by the players before they put their plan into action. Mm-hmm. But if the players or their opponents do things correctly and luck is on their side, there's no reason why combat should last any longer than three rounds, because they scoped out their angles of advantage built a plan and executed upon that plan. It's, you know, every fight should be Bin Laden's compound, basically.
Ideally, yes. Now, that being said, I think it's more important, like, since this is a game, not only to have it last a reasonable and believable and useful amount of time in the game world, but also at the table. Yes. And Horde Wars is designed very strongly to ensure that the game continues moving and that you keep getting to interact in combat and that you're not spending long periods of time between turns. It's also designed to let you fight fairly large numbers of opponents. And Ryan, I hope we can get you in a game at some point soon, man. I think you'd have fun.
I really want to play this game. I really want to give it a try. It's honestly, it just is coming down to the schedule of having a family, having a project that I'm working on and doing this show and everything. But yes, I need to make some time to play in a Horde Wars game with you guys, because this does sound like a really fun system.
Well, and I'll put it this way. We had players coming over when we've demoed and play tested this live at conventions. We've had players come over who were playing Pathfinder and D&D, watch the game, and express to us how surprised they were with how quickly our combat was moving. Mm. Even though in our game, the players were fighting like 30 opponents. And in the game they just left, they were fighting like two.
Yeah.
And that was reflecting not the in-game time, that was the time it took for the players.
Yep.
You know. But there's a lot of design things we could talk about that we use to make that happen and maintain tactical depth.
Gotcha. Well, we are at time for this evening. As we are closing out, I've got one final question. This one's for Nathan, but you know, Blackwall, you've answered this. You can change your answer if you want to. Nathan, the answer to this question can be as philosophical or as sophomoric as you want it to be. But if you could put anything on a t-shirt, what would it be?
Hopefully the people which took the job from are the good guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just keep thinking of that, and I can't remember the name of the British sketch show, but the one guy looking at it, they're going, oh, Hans, are we the baddies?
Yes.
Yes. Sometimes the answer is most definitely yes, and you just roll with it. And other times you're like, we're on the good side. Yeah. I changed my mind halfway through, but because I think I used the other one I would normally use, which is why target me.
You know what you did.
I know what I did. There's, yeah, no, sometimes it's like, no. What? The betrayal? Why? I didn't do anything yet.
Yeah, that's the word, Nate. Yeah.
I know. Yes.
This is a future crime situation.
Yes. You know, Bromstein's, you know.
Yep.
Yet.
So as we're closing out, just want to remind everyone once again, you can find information, at least on Twitter, from Blackwall's handle here, which is @DM_Blackwell. And you can also order this game off of Big Geek Emporium if you are looking for the PDF. For those of you who are watching after the fact, you will find all of this information in the pinned comment under this video. So that's Big Geek Emporium. The link is here in chat for those of you watching live. And if you want a physical copy, you can, of course, email hordewars@blackwallgames.com. I'm going to put that up here on the screen one more time for those of you who are watching. And again, those of you who are watching after the fact, you can find this pinned in the comment underneath this video.
Perfect.
So guys, thank you so much for coming on. This has been a blast, and we'll definitely have to do this again sometime soon.
Thanks for having us.
Yep. Thank you for having us on.
Cool. Well, guys, that's it for Rollin' Bones this evening. Next week, you guys know him and love him. This will be the first of many recurring visits from my business partner and creative partner, the Wonky. He will be back on Rolling Bones. We'll be talking design every time that he comes on. And this next topic, or this first topic rather, is going to be an interesting one. How to develop an idea into a product. That's what we'll be talking about next week. I'm looking forward to it. I know Wonky's looking forward to it. And you guys love Wonky, so I know you're all looking forward to it. So until next time, whether you rolled a 1 or a 20, I'm so glad that you rolled your bones with me, Ryan Howard, and I will see you guys on the other side.